Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 9th, 2002. This session is The Fear of Being Nobody That Deadens Our Aliveness in the Manifesting the Spirit and Love of God. This session is presented by Dale Jamtgaard. Let's listen in.
And there the bell rings so we can officially begin. I remember as a child reading a verse, when I look at the heavens, and I can't quote it all right now, "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" And I thought, that's a good question. Just who are we, or what are we, or what are we about? And I believe understanding that has great implications for how we live life. Jesus says, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And he was quoting Deuteronomy, and let's see, in Deuteronomy it says that God had led them in the wilderness that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but that man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. What does that say to you? Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God.
We need a little spiritual sustenance to keep us going sometimes, I think, to something besides what we take in through our mouth.
Okay.
The difference between living and existing, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. That man is both physical and spiritual.
Okay, that there is a spiritual being. That to live is dependent on the Word of God. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that those are some good thoughts. And let's begin to explore that. Now, where do you think the soul is?
Right here. Someone said the soul is our personality.
Okay.
He doesn't save souls, he saves people who have personality.
Uh-huh. It's virtual space.
Okay. Meister Eckhart, one of the 12th century mystic, says the soul is not in the body. The body is in the soul. And in general, we tend to think of the soul as in there. And one of my concerns about that is we tend then to think in terms of that our primary reality is physical, and the soul is somehow a part of it. It's a part of the physical. We do the same thing with mind. We tend to say the brain is a product of the body, and the thought then is a product of the brain, and that it all comes out of the physical. So we tend to make the physical the greatest reality. And it's like we give it priority, it's more real. And because of that, we tend then to think in terms of the spiritual or even the mind as kind of a secondary reality. Now that may have some validity if we consider our history. Human beings, well, first, the universe is, estimates range from 20 to 40,000 million years old. And the life on the planet, let me see, I gotta get these figures here. The Earth, oh, that's the universe. The Earth is thought to be 4 to 5,000 million years old. And then life, single cell life on the Earth is like 1,000 years old. And then there was a complexity of animals with the sexual reproduction introduced. And so when we get down to human beings or our species in the broad sense, the estimates have been 30,000 years. So we've really come around here very recently. To give you a little image of it, I heard that if the life of the universe was in terms of days, it would have lasted 2 days, and the human beings would last at the stroke of midnight on the second day. To give you an image, we're a little bleep on the end. And so certainly there has been at least a lot of matter around, and certainly a complexification of our mind patterns. Now what has happened is that we, because of this physical orientation that developed with Newtonian physics, we began to think with Newtonian physics of a mechanical world that could be explained by cause and effect, that we could test by observation, and that we could understand this whole mechanical process. And I think in a lot of ways we bought that in the church. So that any activity that was outside of that neat cause and effect pattern, we attributed to, say, a miracle or an intervention of God. That God was out there, and the earth was essentially rolling along, and we were going to be able to explain it, and that if there was any alteration in it, that we explained it then as a miracle. That somehow God reached into the natural process and zapped it. This limited us a great deal in terms of how we understood Jesus. The things that Jesus did, then we began to say, must be miracles. Jesus did what he did in order to prove that he was divine. And therefore, we shouldn't expect to be able to do any of that. And as a result, Jesus said, hey, greater things than I do will you do. He said to his disciples, go heal, go do, go proclaim. Ask and it shall be given, seek and you shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. And notice how we've diminished that so that we say, well, I don't know that I can really expect a miracle at this point. I don't know that it's really going to make any difference. And maybe those were just stories anyway of the disciples trying to show how great Jesus was. He didn't really mean that those things were possibilities. So, oftentimes then we say, well, we believe in prayer, we believe in miracles, but it's very difficult in our framework to imagine God intervening. One of the things is, if we are like a machine, if it's all kind of a set pattern, it's a pretty unexpected, unique experience if God's going to interrupt that whole process. So one of the things that's happening right now is we're making some paradigm shifts. And one of the paradigm shifts that is helping us is that quantum physics and the physics of relativity are beginning to change our view of reality. They're beginning to say, no, this isn't a nice, neat cause and effect. On one level, it looks like that and seems to work like that. But on other levels, there's a randomness, there's a mystery we can't seem to explain. One of the things that happens is that electrons disappear here and appear over here. And they say, we don't know how it got there. We can't find any path. Another one is that the Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy says that we can't really know what's real because whatever we use to look at it with will change what it is. The tools, even our human observation, changes what happens. And so it's hard to know exactly what happens, and even that little thing of being observed can change the dynamics. So we're saying it's not like a machine, it's so subtle, it can be changed by very little things. Another one is that that you are essentially made up of 99.99999% space, yet you have the appearance of being solid.
More or less.
Who says that? maybe too solid. Let me see, I had a nice way of imaging this. Anyway, if you blew an orange up to the size of the Earth, an atom would be the size of a cherry. And the nucleus of that atom would be just a small, very small speck of sand in the atom. And the rest is space. So, that changes our sense of the dynamic. One of the things, again, that we've tended to think of things as its, what we're finding on the subatomic level is that things are really happenings. We boil down from molecules to atoms, to electrons and neutrons and protons, and then down, those are made up of subatomic particles, and you hear the terms quarks and bosons, and talking about discovering a new one called muons. Well, I read a definition of a boson, and it was that a boson is a momentary burst of energy that lasts a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a second. So that we are not made up of strictly its, but they are happenings. So that we become a dynamic happening, not a it. But that creates then a different kind of model. And yet we have a history. On the DNA level, you have 97.5% of the same DNA material as chimpanzees. How isn't that comforting?
Well, they have 97% of ours.
Maybe that's the way. So, when we had the image of being an it with the Newtonian orientation, and then Jesus said, if you have faith, you can. We thought, you know, what difference can faith make to a machine? After all, faith can't affect a machine that much. Well, what I think is exciting is as we begin to get a much more dynamic of a person as a happening, not an it, that the relationship of faith and matter, or mind and matter, becomes much more viable. Now we're moving into this after a lot of this was believed and thought in older times, but our course through Newtonian physics had kind of poo-pooed shamans and other people, healers and other ideas and thinking. Even the placebo effect, even though doctors saw it repeatedly, they said it's just an accident. And there was very little money spent on research on the placebo effect, even though everyone knew about it. And the placebo effect, as you know, is that the belief in a medicine greatly influences the power of the medicine. So what's happening is we're coming to say, wait a minute, this mind that we thought maybe was just a product of a few brain cells may be a very powerful force, that maybe mind and matter are interactive. Maybe what you think is as important as what you are in terms of how your body functions. What you take in spiritually is as important as what you take in nutritionally. And as we open up to this kind of a different kind of dynamic, it's got a lot of potentiality. Now it shouldn't surprise us, this whole interaction of mind and matter. And God said, and it was. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And all things were made through Him. And the Word becomes flesh. And Jesus then says the words, the kingdom of God is at hand. You can know forgiveness and love and mercy as we share this word of God's love and mercy. That the word transforms. And then he said, hey, you guys, if you ask, it's going to be given. If you say the word, you can affect the course of history. You can affect the course of the natural events. And science is finally saying, huh? What? And so they've begun doing research. And what are some of the studies? Anyway, in fact, there was a, you know, we've talked about the prayer and belief in prayer. And then there were some studies done by people who were Christian, and they had 387, the TARC study down in San Francisco, I think it was 387 heart patients, and they divided them into two groups, one group that was prayed for, and the other group that wasn't prayed for. And they were Christians praying, this fellow was a Christian. And so they did the study, and they said, lo and behold, those who were prayed for needed less medications, less treatment, of lower percentage of fatality, significant differences in the group that was prayed for. They didn't know they were being prayed for. So another study in the San Francisco area on AIDS took even a larger sample. And they had Christians and Jews and Mohammedans and Buddhists and Hindus and so forth praying. And they found a similar kinds of results, that the groups didn't even know whether they're being prayed for or not. They tried to eliminate all the kinds of things that where people say, aha, you cheated on that one. And instead they followed every protocol they could, and they found again the significant influence of prayer on the group that was prayed for. And so Harvard had a conference on healing, faith healing. Now, how's that for status? Harvard University saying, hey, maybe we ought to talk about this. Maybe we ought to think about it. And now Duke and Harvard and others are doing major studies trying to test the whole idea of prayer. But just think of what that means, that somehow if people believe and pray and trust that their prayer, their intention somehow is related to a change in the course of history, the change in the course of nature. Do we have that potential of being word sayers? What does it mean to be a word sayer? Well, what is mind? Is it just a product of the brain? That's beginning to say with prayer that somehow there's a way that these prayers connect. Other kinds of things that have raised these questions for us. There's a book by Larry Dossey called Reinventing Medicine. And he's a physician. And as a physician, he said, hey, there seems to be a lot to this prayer stuff. And he wasn't, I think he was acquainted with the Christian faith, but was not really, didn't consider himself a Christian. So he, well, first he had an experience. He had a dream, and he dreamed that a colleague's son came into the hospital and had some kind of a stroke or something, and he needed to have an electrocardiogram, and he resisted putting on the equipment. And the next morning he comes in and he's talking, and this doctor comes to him and says, hey, you know what happened? My son came to the emergency this morning. Boy, the anesthesiologist had a real trouble on the electrocardiogram. People had real trouble, he just resisted. And this doctor goes, whoa, how did I know that? How could that be true? And he had several more experiences right at that time. And then he said, I haven't had much later. But it caused him to begin to question. And he also then began questioning, well, maybe there's something to prayer. And he began studying it. And he said, I found 150 studies on prayer that predominantly seemed to say that there is an effectiveness to prayer. And so he began saying, what are the implications of this? And he's written several books on prayer itself, and then he wrote this book, and he said the implications for it, to me, call for a whole reinventing of our approach to medicine. That's why he calls it reinventing medicine. He reports on those studies on prayer, and then he also said, but there's a lot of other things that just raise questions about the reality. For instance, he said one story, an Irish soldier in World War I had a dog, and he went home on leave for a few days, and then he went back in, and he was about 60 miles in a foxhole. There were 500,000 British and other troops around him, and his dog came across the channel and found him in the middle of the battlefield in the foxhole. And he says, wow. You know, all our ways of explaining this in terms of odors and magnetic sense and all this kind of thing, he says, nothing can explain that we have. No known ways of explanation can explain how that dog found its owner. And he goes on and tells some other stories that kind of stretch things. One very locally, a family in Ohio had packed up and were moving to Oregon. And along the way back in near Ohio, they lost the dog. And they said, well, we can't wait, we gotta go. And so they moved to Oregon, and 3 months later, after winter, why the dog finds and shows up on the doorstep. What kind of connection can this be? Another one, a homing pigeon is taken to a homing pigeon race, and the fellow lives in Northern England, and they take him over to France and then release him, and then they time how long it takes them to get back to their lofts. And so this pigeon doesn't come home, and they wait and wait and wait and can't figure out what happened. Finally, they get a letter from Morocco and says, this pigeon showed up in our loft, and what do you want us to do with him? They said, well, if the pigeon wants to be there rather than here, let the pigeon stay. And then the pigeon's nephew is born. And as soon as that pigeon can fly, it flies from England to the loft in Morocco. So more experiments are being done with this, saying there are ways that we are interconnected that defy our paradigms. One of them you've probably heard recently would clock a dog and its boss, and when the boss would get up at work at quite a distance away to ready to come home, the dog would go up and post itself by the door, and they timed it and found that each entity where they found them correlating. And the boss would get up at different, or the worker would get up at various times and prepare to go home, and the dog would respond. You've probably had these kinds of experiences yourselves, ways of communicating. A lady in one of my churches, in the middle of the service, grabbed her arm, walked out of the service, and received a phone call that her son had broken his arm right where she felt the pain. Now, communicating seems to be one thing. Knowing the future seems to stretch our paradigms even further. I've had a couple of experiences that kind of blow my mind and stretch my paradigms. One of them was that I was returning from Alaska after having done some stress workshops, and I was tired, I didn't want to read, so I decided I would do an exercise that I had learned for knowing another person. And the way I would do it would be to just open up my hands and have that sense of knowing the person through my hands. And I think the value of that was just to get me out of my head. There's nothing you can figure, there's nothing you can make happen. It's like tuning in or participating and being receptive. So I just sat there like that and let the images come to me. So when the stewardess was coming down the line, for some reason, a real chatty stewardess talking to people about their hotel and their plane connections. I've never seen another one do it, but Alaska was giving service, I guess. So anyway, she gets to me and I said, I'm playing this game, and I explained what I was doing, and I said, you mind if I check some of these images out to see if there's anything to it? She said, oh, okay. What could she say when she's trying to be nice? So I started and I said, well, the first image is that there's a man in your life and he's sitting at a table with accounting papers. And she said, well, I'm getting a divorce, but my husband is a banker. Oh, okay. Second one I said is that I have an image of some real trouble around your heart. She said, well, I'm not aware of a physical problem, but I've had a lot of heartache the last couple of years. Okay, that was kind of a generic one. The third one I said is that I see you taking care of two small children and you haven't had a baby. She looks at me and says, you're right, I haven't had a baby. And I'm living with my sister, helping her take care of her two small children. And the fourth one I said is that I see you getting off the plane at Portland and going to visit some friends. And one of your friends' name is Laura. She said, you're right, I'm going to get off the plane and go visit some friends in Portland. But none of my friends there is named Laura. I do have a friend in Alaska named Laura. Okay. That's all. Thank you. And she went on her way. As I was coming off the plane, there she was standing. And she said, how did you do that? And so we were chatting as we went into the airport. I was trying to explain what I couldn't explain, but what I did anyway. And as we were walking along, a gal comes up to her and gives her a great big hug. And she turns to me and says, I'd like to have you meet my friend Laura. What? See, I have no way of knowing that. To call that accident? No, there's something going on. There's ways of knowing and even knowing, pre-knowing. That shouldn't surprise us. The scriptures is full of prophecy and prophets in that idea. So there's a lot of things that happen in scriptures that I think are really in the realm of potentiality, and that God can open us up to them and can help us use them. Now, they can be misused. Certainly, any ability can be misused. Just to, it wasn't the only experience. Ricky and I had a dear friend who was principal of her school, and her wife was taking care of him as he was suffering from cancer. And she was having more trouble, so different ones of us were going in and helping her take care of him. So this evening, while Ricky and I went over to take care of him, and Ricky and the wife took the first time, and then I came in around 12:30 or so, and he was not conscious. He was sleeping. I don't know how unconscious he was, but I just kind of prayed with him, and then I just had that sense of I'm just going to be with him. I don't know what this means. I have nothing I can do. I'm just going to be with him and let him know I'm here with him, like Jesus saying, lo, I'm with you. And as I sat there with that sense of just openness and presence, all of a sudden the idea came, he will die at 4:58. Whoa, that, how could I know that? That can't be. And I didn't want to believe it at that point. And so I just sat, and then as he didn't talk or gain consciousness at all, and at about 4:30, his breathing got heavier, and at 4:58, he went. What I'm drawing out of this is because we need the Word to have life, the deepest need of a human being is for meaning. That we have a deep sense of needing to have a sense of significance, a sense of meaning. And this grows out of then the point at which we as human beings became self-conscious. As we became aware of ourselves, we raised the question, who am I and what is my worth? What is my meaning? What is my significance? And I really believe that that is the deepest meaning for us, or deepest need in life. And what I mean by that is, people have been able to forego great discomfort, great ills, even sacrifice their life, because it meant something to them. It was about what they were about as a person. And so my sense is that it is possible for us to even forego a lot of other kinds of things because of that meaning. Now, that's the positive sense of it. Our need for meaning is what drives us. And because we have that great need, it becomes the area of temptation. And so the title I put up on the board was "The Fear of Being Nobody Blocks Our Capacity to Live Fully as the Person We Are." And that deep down in all of us is that fear of being nobody. And it gets in the way. Now, let me... Where are we? Oh, yes. I wanted to bring that back then to what is a human being. And that if our deepest need, or one is if we are who we are by the Word of God, then I think that we are a happening, we're not an it, and that God is manifesting us. Now there's a verse in Scripture that says, if your eye is sound, your whole body will become full of light, and you become bright as a lamp. That, for me, creates an image, and that is that when Jesus talks about our being the light, I am the light, you are the light, receive the light, be filled with the light. If your eye is sound, you will be filled with light. Faith for me is a way of receiving the light of God. So that let me start with the opposite. That we've tended to think of, I'm here and God is there. And it's nice to have a relationship with God. And faith is kind of creating that relationship with God. But it's like we have a choice. And my sense is that we don't really have a choice. That our every moment of existence, that what Jesus means is that our every moment of existence, God is saying the word that makes us alive. And it's how we receive that. Now there are different images. Receive my spirit. You are love, receive, abide in the love. Abide in my love, abide in me. And so the image that I've arrived at is that we are a dynamic happening. We're always happening. And that God is always saying the word of love, the word of light, and the word of spirit that become us. That we are an ongoing manifestation of God's love, light, and spirit. That's what it means to be in God's image. And that, so man shall not live by bread alone. Yes, we receive the bread from the earth, but that also what we are is a dynamic spirit. We are the light of God. We are the love of God. That's what we are designed to be and do. Now, a homely image of that. That we are like a television set. We can be plugged in and have a little light and life from nature. But without the sending station, a television set cannot be a television set. So the sending station sends all these waves and color and sound and words and meaning and music and so forth. But it is only as the television set tunes in to the sending station that the television set comes to life, that it really catches on. And so as you tune in, and I think this is maybe what faith is about. Faith isn't I'm here, God is there, I'm going to believe in God. But it is, faith is belief in God, but it is also participating in the presence of God's love, light, and spirit. And so as we tune in faith, and Jesus keeps saying that if you have faith, you can. If you have faith, you are. If you have faith, your faith has made you whole. That kind of language. As we tune in, we begin to get clearer. And the pictures get clearer, the color gets brighter, and we come to life. Now that sounds like the language of Jesus when he said, I came that you might have life, that you move from deadness to aliveness, that you be more fully alive than you are. And this is where that fear of being nobody then comes in. The fear of being nobody says, don't trust, don't believe, don't have faith. And that's being out of tune. And we get static and noise and fuzz and snow on our television sets. And so I'd like to put out that I think this is a kind of image that fits, one, the new paradigms of physics. I think it fits the idea that God didn't just create the world and said that God is always creating. I heard that in an earlier session. God is always creating and saying the word that creates, and that each of us then are a child of God, manifestation of God's love, light, and spirit. Let me throw that one out and appreciate your questions or reactions.
Are you negating the physical then?
No. The physical is only a part. It's the slower moving particles. And the other realities, light for instance, is not a material substance, just the way consciousness is not. So those are substances that don't have physical, but they seem to be affected and shaped.
And they have dynamic powers.
And they have dynamic power. And we're coming to think that not only the brain has consciousness, but every cell in our body has a consciousness to it. Mm-hmm. That every organism has a consciousness.
Excuse me. Wouldn't you also say that even though the DNA of 97 or whatever percent apes, don't we have a little bit of all of that human history in our system too, and that evolution has caused us to come up with different responses to those? You know, we start with fear and different levels of awareness, that we knew God, he's our protector, we're afraid, and so as we go through these levels that quantum physics starts, and that's sooner or later you get to the virtual reality, because there are no dimensions in the spiritual world, and we can't imagine it. Mm-hmm. But we start out with all of that, all of human history is in our DNA, in our minds, in our body. Every one of us, I think, have some of that back in whatever ages.
Now you raise an interesting kind of question. You know, certainly all these capacities may have been present, but does the coming of Jesus set us free in a new way in the...
Definitely.
Is it a turning point as human beings are evolved? Do we, and we can say it another way, do we not as human beings need to arrive at a new level of way of functioning, or we're going to destroy ourselves? We're going to destroy the earth with our technologies and our wastes and destroy each other.
Seems before Jesus, all we had was the physical. You know, we needed him to move to the next level of consciousness.
And
raising awareness, I guess. You know, before that, we weren't aware of Jesus.
Okay. And certainly some of it is there in the Old Testament.
Yes.
And
but I didn't see it yet.
Well, and Jesus brings it into a real dynamic living presentation. Another way of saying this is that we often say that Jesus came to reveal God to us. And I'm wondering also if Jesus didn't come to reveal the fullness of humanity. That he's really saying, hey, look who you are, what you can do, what you can be.
Do you think our biggest problem is because we can't put it in physical terms and visualize that fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh dimension?
I think that's a real problem because Jesus says the kingdom comes and you will not be able to observe it. You will not be able to nail it down.
And we put God into a personal, physical being, which we know it's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of mind-stretching.
Earlier in your discussion, you mentioned that when you were talking about the soul and the body, that we may have it confused as to which is the larger. And what popped in my head at that second was, people will frequently say, you're in my space. Mm-hmm. Are our souls intermeshing and one is not liking the other one for some reason or other?
Now, where is your body?
Up in the air.
Okay, we tend to say, this is it. But notice, you've got a heat body, you've got a vapor body, you've got an electromagnetic body, you've got a magnetic body, you've got a light body, an energy body, and you may have a telepathic body, the field with which your mind can function. And so how big are we and how interactive we are? Oh, I was going to show you something that's happening here. Kind of a medical health picture. They're showing people with halos. Mm-hmm. How about that?
Who is?
Well, I don't know. This happened to be McGraw-Hill's products. Anyway.
Oh, really?
On the health professions are emerging.
Nursing, a lot of nursing books are written by them.
So, but we're shifting in our understanding of what a human being is. Yeah.
A couple things that come to mind that relate to your discussion. One, I was reading an essay recently by David James Duncan, who's a fly fisherman and a great writer from Oregon, now lives in Montana. And he's writing in the latest edition of Orion, which there's a copy of it outside here, actually in the library. And it's he writes about the new science or the cutting edge of physics these days, and over again cites examples of how scientists are beginning to need to use the language of poetry, is how he puts it, to describe, quote unquote, physical reality or what they're discovering in their research, because it can't be described in the language that scientists usually use, I guess. The other is that in working on the connections between faith and ecology and worldview and our impact on the natural world, if we consider our self, our body, as simply our skin-encapsulated ego, then acting in our self-interest is really quite limited if our self is simply right here. But if our self is indeed larger than that, and we are an enpeopled self and a natured self, if indeed we are defined by the relationships that make us up, at least that is part of who we are, then it becomes easier to even imagine operating ways which might not immediately seem to be in our self-interest. It's an ecological worldview, it seems to me, to expand our sense of self beyond our own skin-encapsulated ego. Solzhenitsyn says that freedom is self, limiting oneself for the sake of others. But when the others are part of yourself, that definition begins to shift for me anyway. So the kind of things you're talking about, I think, are also very helpful in addressing how we're going to move toward living sustainably, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And you raised at the end of your session today, how can we do anything about this? This optimism of Jesus. If people are primarily influenced through their mind connection, the more we can be of one mind, the more we can truly trust and believe something, it will ripple through the minds of the world. That it's possible to change mind view. And maybe this is what is meant about have the mind of Christ in you. Part of what I'm doing is beginning to try to say, how do we really tune in to the optimism of Jesus about what's possible? Because we so discount it. Oh, we can't do that, we can't do that, you know. What difference could we make, kind of thing. But I think we can.
Do you think that those experiences that you had have anything to do with intuition or what I call your gut feeling about things that are happening? Sometimes I get this, you know, I'll be in a situation where I have a gut feeling about what I should do or what I should say or where I should go. And so many times I negate it. I decide, you know, I must be wrong. And then I wasn't wrong. Now, is that the kind of thing you're thinking of?
Well, there are different ways of knowing, different levels of knowing. This is a kind of knowing that was very foreign to me because I thought you had to learn the data and figure it out.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of an insight level of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this other level of kind of an intuitive knowing where we kind of let go of our having to think it through,
mm-hmm.
and we have a sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then scripture uses another term, and that's inspiration, to breathe in, to know. Maybe the way we know God is presence.
Mm-hmm.
Just God is.
Mm-hmm.
God is with. God, and as we open up at that deeper level. And so one of the issues for us is how focused and how busy we keep our minds so that we're not really open to these other ways of knowing. That if we're always figuring it out and mm-hmm. putting it all together.
Gathering more data all the time.
It's pretty hard to get our attention.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just another demonstration of how we haven't figured out the healing prayer part is another smaller study, I think it was New Mexico, of alcoholics, I think it was, where half of them were prayed for and the other half weren't. And they didn't especially want to recover or to be healed. And the ones prayed for actually did more poorly. So a lot of it is receptivity, I guess, whether they know it or not. Mm-hmm. The cardiac patients all wanted to get better.
Jesus has a great story for that. He goes to the man by the pool of Bethesda, the paralyzed man who has trouble getting into the pool. Now, we would assume that that man, he says, man, I've been waiting here, 38 years, or, you know, and everyone always beats me into the pool and tells his story. And Jesus says, do you want to be healed? Now, why wouldn't he?
It's part of his identity.
That's right. He had built a whole sense of self, a whole identity around being the poor man who always got beat into the pool. And he would probably want to hang on to that more than letting go of it and be healed. That's, again, my point about the meaning of a person. That's how important our meaning is. And we're going to deal a lot with that tomorrow night. How this deep fear of being nobody leads us to develop a somebody. And what we're going to be looking for then, Jesus says, you must die in order to live. You must lose life to find it. And then he says, come die with me. Not just I died for you. There's a truth to that, but we miss it if we don't hear him also say, come die with me. Let that old self experience a death. And so we're going to be talking about what is that old self and what does it mean to die in order to really be set
free. Is that a warning, Dale?
Well, you've already had that talk from Mike this morning, so it'll be duplicity. Okay, well, I'd like to just end on this tickler. Far more is possible than you can imagine. And every time I bump into that, I say, wait a minute, what's getting in the way? How am I blocking those real capacities? And dare I believe it? Thanks. Have a good night.